This is Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Hardim. Toronto's news, today's talk, 640 Toronto.
It's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas, right? Sure it is. I just got back from my little staycation. My daughter has been begging me to go skiing, so I had the privilege of going out to Banff for a few days, a pre-Christmas ski. 6 feet of snow, spectacular weather. Oh, so nice, and I do feel for the ski industry here in Ontario. I'm actually going to be bringing on Wally Crowder's son, Glenn Crowder, an avid skier, and he's actually doing a show on 640 now, a lifestyle and wellness program, and he's always been a ski expert, so he'll be joining us sometime in January talking about the business of skiing. I like business. We talk about the business of music later in the show as well. That's an industry I'm very, very dear to, but right now, it's rock and roll, the real rocks, copper, gold, silver. I have an expert out in Vancouver. That's what BC does real well, metals and mining. And I got a really, really dear friend of mine, a veteran at Canaccord, Mr. Cam Curry, a senior investment advisor. Good friend of mine, and going to graciously share with us some of his thoughts on metals and mining right here, right now. Cam, Merry Christmas and welcome to Hi-Fi Radio. It's a first for you, baby. Let's have some fun.
Wolfgang, thanks so much for the invite. By the way, we're still waiting for snow out here. Banff has it all, but we don't have a lot at Whistler. So
yeah, you are.
It's arriving right. Christmas Day.
You are a big skier. And, you know, I thought about you, as a matter of fact, in Banff, because last time I saw you, I think you might even be a year or two older than I, but it doesn't matter. But you told me you like to ski really hard and really fast. And just the way you said it with such confidence, I found it actually quite intimidating. I do feel myself getting a little older and slowing her down. Greens and blues. Believe it or not, you'll find me on the greens and blues cam. But I don't fall. I don't get hurt. And I spend time with my daughter. So
a good 6 feet. You're a West Coast skier. I mean, all we do is ski the chutes and all that kind of stuff. So if you grew up here, you'd be along the same lines. So.
I skied some great chutes in France at 12 at and a pair of 205 vocals.
But so you want to talk rocks?
Why not? Let's talk rocks. I had my rocks. My skis were taken up with a bit of rock out west, but not too bad. But gold versus copper. Bit of a debate, I shall say. I look at the market and, you know, you see Bitcoin waking up. Gold, you know, was flirting, I think, with an all-time high this year. Copper, industrial metal, I see a lot of building going on. Home construction and building stocks hitting all-time highs. I'm seeing the industrial sector looking stronger. But with electrification, you got to think copper should be trading near an all-time high. And it's not. It's still trading below $4. You're an expert in the space, Cam. And you did say to me last time I saw you, you're selling your copper stocks. That was about, what, 8-9 months ago. And that actually really gave me credence to maybe I should lighten up as well. And I came home. I said, Jack, one of our guys, Cam Curry, who knows copper, I think, really, really well, is lightening up on the position. So I think that was a good call you made then.
As you say, they're cyclical and they need to be traded.
So from here, Cam, where are you with copper?
Well, first of all, I love copper long-term, and we've had some great successes. When I say selling, I was lightening up on some core positions because I just saw an economic slowdown coming. Mm-hmm. And again, the stock market trading a new all-time highs this week in the U.S. is, quite honestly, it's shocking to me in terms of the movement up. But a lot of it's the last 6 weeks where a lot of Johnny-come-latelys came in because they were flat-footed. On the copper side, copper has a PhD in economics. Uh-huh. And that's one of the driving forces behind the decline in copper prices. But the big story for copper going forward, and I'm looking sometime in mid-late 24 to really add to my copper positions, I don't know time-wise, because the supply side is a huge problem. You look at all the big copper projects in the world these days. I mean, the Chinese and the Russians control a lot of them. A lot of them are in Africa. The political challenges down in South America continue. We have the Cobre Panama problem with First Quantum. So supply is going to be a big, big problem going forward. And most people don't realize that, you know, from a discovery of a copper project to first production is 15 to 20 years. And the CapEx is anywhere from $3 to $7 billion. So there's been no money going into the ground to develop future projects.
Sorry, Cam, you're throwing a lot of good stuff on the table here. I want to make sure people don't miss the buffet. Again, copper having a PhD in economics. Point there is copper really is used in almost anything and everything built.
Absolutely.
And that's very, very important. So if copper is not in demand, that means end product is not in demand. When copper is in demand, and when end product is in demand, copper is in demand. So it is a good gauge of economic activity.
Absolutely.
But in terms of geopolitical risk, you covered off a lot of bases there too, but Canada certainly is a friendly jurisdiction nation. That does give us a leg up over other parts of the world. But the 15 to 20 year lead time to build a mine, minimum cost, what, some $7 billion. That's fascinating. That is fascinating because our last bull market, and that's when I actually entered the market on Bay Street, 2001. The reason we had such a wonderful run in the first decade of this millennia here in Canada, U.S. was flat. U.S. was in a secular bear market from 2000 to 2012, 2015. It was a secular bear market where the S&P 500 went nowhere. Canada was on steroids, and that's when the loonie went to par. And reason being, underbuilding of mines. And all of a sudden, you had a pinch point and no supply, good demand. And whammo, copper went 450. So do you see
a lot of that had to do with also, don't forget, I mean, China build out. I mean,
China build out, that's right. China build out.
And now we have a different situation here where if you look at China, they overbuilt. And I think the unemployment amongst the male youth between 18 and 25 is like 22%. So what you
in
have
China?
Now is you have an.
In China?
In China. So now you have an overbuilt.
Unemployment.
China.
Sorry, Cam. Unemployment in China amongst the 18 to 20
male youth between the age of 18 and 25 is like 20% right now. That's how much their economy slowed down. And so much of their economy was infrastructure build-out. And look at the overbuilding. So now they're saying, reports I read, 4 to 6 years to digest the overbuild of China. So think about the copper demand side there. Now, the big unknown in copper is the EV evolution. EV requires a lot of copper. And so that's why the demand is going to continue to be strong.
Well, but, I think that's the obvious trade in copper.
Yeah.
And again, the fact that I see something being obvious means it probably isn't. You know, electrification, no combustible engines, these new mandates that were being presented with around the world look unattainable.
They are.
But, they are pushing towards some kind of a goal. And look, you and I have been to Europe a few times. We certainly see a greener environment in Europe today than we would have 20 some odd years ago. And I just think about going into Innsbruck, skiing Innsbruck, Cam. Have you skied Europe, by the way?
I have.
Yeah. But do you remember skiing Europe 20 years ago around all the major ski drop-off zones where these buses that bus people in, they're all running on diesel. The town stunk of diesel. Mm-hmm. Not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, you go to China, too, and you go to Beijing, for example, and you'll see two different color license plates. And there's the green and there's, I think, the red. And the red represents combustible engines. The green is EV. And one of our bankers, actually, one of our Dalton Barada, who's our base metal analyst, was there recently. And he told me, you look at the cars, 50% are green now. So they're pushing it much more aggressively there. I just came back from California, and I drove all the way back with my road bikes and that. And
so with your what?
Right now, my road bikes. I was down in Palm Springs riding. And I'm too young to golf. But point being is that, California, which is the epicenter of Tesla, you see a lot of Teslas around. But I can tell you right now, the infrastructure required to meet the mandate of 2035 in California is not going to happen. There's just no way. The infrastructure required and the electricity that has to be created to electrify California or the United States for that matter, there's just no way it can happen. And the economics, people aren't going to be pushed. You see these people driving older cars. They can't afford to buy electric cars.
You know, our next hit, we're going to bring on a good friend of mine, Steve Kane. I'm going to have to ask you, Steve, when did they electrify the guitar? Do you know?
Oh, 30s?
In the 30s, eh?
Yeah.
Was it Les Paul maybe who did it?
Yeah, Les Paul.
Really? I got that right.
Yeah,
well,
you got that right.
Good guess.
And, so Charlie Christensen was probably the first electric guitar star, and he was 20s.
Friend, a little teaser.
30s,
Mr.
Crazy.
Steve Kane, former president of Warner Music Group in Canada. That's going to be a fun interview. Looking forward to that. If I may, with you, Cam Curry, my base metal friend out in Vancouver, senior investment advisor with CG Wealth. By the way, if you really like base metals, if you really like junior and mid-cap gold names, honestly, I'm not your guy. Cam Curry is. You can find him on our website. What a plug I gave. What a gentleman I am.
Thank you.
Well, you deserve
it. You're truly a gentleman. Well, I tell you, let's go to the precious metals for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, I was actually just, I moderated a fireside chat between chair of the World Gold Council and the CEO of World Gold Council recently. And, it's a fascinating situation. I mean, gold is trading at all-time highs. and yet nobody's paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really significant, it's a Western phenomenon, because you go to the Eastern banks, Eastern buyers, they're the buyers of gold, whereas the ETF ownership in the United States and Europe have gone from 3,500 tons to 2,700 tons. So the Western world's not paying attention to what the Eastern world is doing. And what you're seeing is you're seeing a movement, a diversification of the U.S. dollars. Because they're looking at the fiscal house. I was just in France. I met with a Monaco banker. And they're very bullish on gold because they see fiscal risk in the deficits of the United States. I mean, the deficit in the United States is $33 trillion.
And rising.
And this year, with unemployment at 3.6%, they still ran a $2 trillion deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start looking at the deficit risk of a fiat currency that can be printed by a government. Or, most people don't realize this, Wolfgang, but gold is one of the top three reserve currencies in the world, U.S. dollar, euro, and gold. But gold's the only one that has no political attachment, no debt obligation, and no printing press. And the Eastern world is buying it in lieu of U.S. dollars because of those characteristics.
Cam, you know what we're going
to
do?
Hasn't paid attention to this.
In the new year, we're going to get you on with Jamie Carrasco. Did you ever chat with Jamie?
I did not.
You should. He's an advisor in Toronto. We bring him on Hi-Fi frequently, but he's okay. From Latin America. So again, his disdain for fiat currency comes from where he comes from, which is Latin America and disrupt or corrupt government, shall I say? Cam, we do have to hop. I am out of time.
No problem,
is terrestrial radio. We got to run a few commercials, which are good things. From our Vancouver office, Mr. Cam Curry, specialist in base metals. He's been in helicopters. I don't know how many times. Kicking the dirt and I don't know how many different continents.
Looking
for gold dust, and he finds it. So a real pleasure. Merry Christmas to you, my friend, and think snow.
Okay. My pleasure. All the best to you, too.
Stay tuned. We're going to be spending some time with Mr. Steve Kane, the former president of the Warner Music Group. I love music, and, well, I like the business of music. We're going to get caught up to speed as to what's taking place right after this.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Hi-Fi Radio in a moment on 640 Toronto.
I love that song. Now, usually, I'll cue that baby up when we have a lawyer on. Here I have the head, or former head, shall I say, of one of the largest music companies in the world, the Warner Music Group, Mr. Steve Kane. And I follow you on social, as you follow me. And I'm always amazed at that beautiful jukebox that you have in your basement, I'm going to assume. And I said, Steve, I'm going to let you do something I never let a guest do. I'm going to let you pick the intro song. And you chose The Clash, Bank Robber. I said, that is such a great tune. Well done.
Well, there you go. It just seemed appropriate in talking about the state of the music business. And
I was surprised by that. So who's Robin who here?
Well, that's the...
Because honestly, you came from the label business. You were always the one doing the Robin. So the artist claimed.
So you
had an artist, put the artist first mantra. And you're one of the good guys. I know that.
Yeah. Well, 35 years working for labels. You know, I saw all the movies, read all the books. and that you know, we were always the bad guys in it, and that was fine. but here's the real crux of it.
I'm a broker, right? Yeah. Same thing. That's fine.
everybody loves music. Everybody sees value in music. But what the music industry, the recorded music industry, has proven themselves to be excellent at year after year, transition after transition, is they're really good at creating the monsters that eat them. You can start with the early days of radio and, you know, not being paid for broadcast. You can shift to the years of MTV, where MTV Much Music, we built those businesses on our content,
mm-hmm.
and received very little back.
Mm-hmm.
We went through the Napster years hoping that we learned something as we saw the crash of the music business and people extracting all the value.
No charge.
And, you know, sharing is caring, which, you know, that was one of the hallmarks of piracy. So flash forward, you make a deal with Apple in the emergence of the download era. 99 cents a song. The view was it's better than nothing.
Uh-huh.
And so we began as the digital era emerged. we were making deals from places of fear and panic. And so when you start at a 99-cent threshold, it took us, I can't even remember, probably 10 years to get to $1.29, to get to variable pricing. And I always loved that Jimmy Page withheld the Led Zeppelin catalog from download stores for many years. And one of the reasons he did that was, he said, if somebody can convince me that Stairway to Heaven is worth the same 99 cents as Oops, Baby, I Did It Again by Britney Spears, then we can have a conversation.
Brilliant.
And that was one of the reasons I was thinking
about that song. What a great song that was. It had the transitions and the licks and number one on the charts forever. To this day, it is such a great song.
And still.
Masterpiece.
Well, here's the funny. My wife just turned 60 recently. We had a bit of a party and we decided on the playlist. take a guess what the very last song on the playlist
Stairway
was.
Stairway to Heaven.
Stairway to Heaven. Wow. It was like being transported back to a high school dance.
Okay, well, honestly, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah.
I think I got rejected when I asked a girl to dance that. I just had to sit at the side for that one.
A long time to be rejected.
That hurts. That's a long time. Well put. Well put. What's remarkable, Steve, and again, I used to love shopping Yonge Street and buying my records and to see the content transform and evolve. I just recently on Netflix watched the making of Bat Out of Hell and the challenge they had finding a label for a record that ultimately ended up selling 35 million copies. And if my math is correct from my record company Diddling's days back when I was in rock radio, an artist would pick up about $2 a unit, $1.50, $2.50,
yeah,
depending on the artist.
About right.
So
yeah.
you sell 35 million copies of Bat Out of Hell, the band should take in about $70 million dollars over time. That's a good living for one album.
Yeah, the publishing. Which obviously Meat Loaf had a part of along with Jim Steinman, the master usage, the sales. Yeah, you could make a very healthy living off of not only one LP, one song.
So, you know, again, we're going to bring you back in January because I love your industry, as you know, and it is a very dynamic industry, a lot of moving parts. But contracts, you know, artist contracts, the legalities of setting up the right contract. I lead with this, Steve, because I don't understand. It was our friend Britney Spears. Am I correct?
Where her father took control. Is that what you're talking about?
No, the one who just re-recorded all of her.
Taylor Swift.
That's what I asked you about. How did she become a billionaire? It was my first question. But how was she also able to reproduce material that was already produced through a label, I'm assuming, who fronted it and paid for the, right? That's how it works. And I want to talk about that in detail, but how did she able to re-record the same material so she get a bigger take of that? How did she pull off that move?
So every traditional recording contract has a re-record clause. And it's usually, again, if I remember correctly, it was usually 15 years after final delivery of the last master on your contract, and you had to be recouped. So that would be able to, you'd be able to go in and re-record. And many people have done it. Nobody with the spectacular success of Taylor, because she's a whole phenomena on her own. Opposite end of the scale, John Prine once took his greatest hits and re-recorded them. The reason John did it was he was getting a lot of offers for film placement, for syncs. So he figured, well, if I re-record them, they can come to me instead of going to Atlantic or Asylum, which were his original labels, and he can offer them at a bit of a discount and keep the whole chunk and not have to share it with the label. So that's not why Taylor did it. And it, you know, she was probably still within her not being able to re-record. But obviously that was part of the settlement. That was probably part of the deal that she cut when she split ways with Big Machine and Scooter Braun. And that has proved enormously successful, both in terms of physical sales and what her fan base, that rabid fan base, choose to stream.
It just shows you, Wolf, how strong her brand truly is. Social media, how strong that phenomenon is, the viral nature of it. And she came to the table with a really strong hand, Wolf. And you know what? I'm going to say she won based on the deal that you're describing here, Steve.
But the talent an artist needs to have today, a very different skill set required today to become a successful artist than it was back when a traditional relationship was created between artist and record company and manager. Things were a lot simpler, but the artist had a lot less control. Now it appears that the artist has a lot of control. And that is, it's a new world.
Yeah, they can choose to take more control. The responsibilities put on an artist these days are really quite cumbersome, and it's a lot. They are expected to be active marketers.
Right.
Some of them are very good at it.
Some are good at it.
Taylor as a great example.
Yeah.
Tegan and Sarah, fantastic brand builders.
Right.
There's others who are just not good at it. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they really still lean heavily on the record companies. And labels put a lot of demands. You have to feed that social media beast to keep engaged, because you don't have the power of radio as it used to be. You don't have much music, which could break an artist on one song. So it's that constant feeding of the machine.
But they have publicists helping them with this. A publicist would, talk what a publicist would do 20 years ago, and what does a publicist do today?
Well, the publicist today, has how it's really changed, is the publicist used to pitch the story to media. Now the publicist, in most cases, writes the story and serves it up to media. You know, we have new departments that are sort of adjacent to publicity. That's the social media department. We never had a social media department.
Right.
Well, we didn't have social media. That's what, when I started, word of mouth was actually talking to people, as opposed to word of mouth being now driven by social media. And artists have to be actively involved in that in a way they never were before.
But again,
have to be very careful, because there's the risk of shedding mystique. We know everything about artists. We know their every move. We know every move Taylor Swift's making
today. Yeah.
We didn't know what Jimmy Page was up to.
But I just look at the brands today, how quick Taylor Swift built her brand. And to me, it appears quick, but it really wasn't. She worked at it probably for 15 or 20 years, Steve?
Yeah, she just turned 34.
Okay. Right? But so then I look at, let's talk Jimmy Page. There's a brand and some, but he's been at it for how long, Steve? 50 years?
Oh.
How long has Zeppelin been around?
At least
50 years.
We've got to be pushing 50 years. Yeah. Keith Richards, God bless Keith Richards.
He's 80.
What was that quote I caught? Willie Nelson, something about the next generation. They have to
be careful what they leave.
leave behind for us. Yes. The next generation must take good care of this planet and leave it nicely behind for us. But unbelievable. What a brand. But that just seemed like a slow, steady build through touring as opposed to digitization.
Yeah. Yeah. My advice to young artists who are, in genres where touring still makes sense, where touring is still a vital part of it, is when you're looking at your record contract, when your manager's doing your first deal, don't worry about the upfront money so much anymore, those big advances. But you make damn sure that there is tour support in there. Because you have to get out on the road. You still have to go and touch people. Now, other genres, some pop genres.
But the Beatles taught us that with their 10,000 hours in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
They played, I think, 3 shows a day for 6 days a week. So you know the history better than I do. But it's something to that effect.
But when you look at, non-touring artists these days, so pop artists these days, how do they communicate? They don't tour. They're on TikTok. They're on, they're on social media. And building that perceived relationship between fan and artist.
Wow. I wanted to drill in a little bit further with my friend Steve Kane, the former president of the Warner Music Group. Such a great industry and such a great business. And we're going to talk a little bit more with Steve. Quick break and get right back to Hi-Fi Radio. Wolfgang Klein, portfolio manager, along with my partner, Jack Hartle, portfolio manager, and Mr. Steve Kane. I feel like I'm sitting here with a very young Neil Young, shall I say. Stay tuned.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Hi-Fi Radio in a moment on 640 Toronto.
Oh, this is going to be a groove for me. It's going to be a little something different, but we're going to give it to him anyway. Are you ready? Come on.
I like it. Thank you, Steve.
Mr. Solomon Burke, the Bishop of Souls.
That's very cool. Solomon Burke?
Solomon Burke.
The Bishop of Soul.
Yeah,
the Bishop of Soul.
That's what he used to call himself.
The Bishop of Soul. So was he after James Brown?
Contemporaries.
Oh, contemporaries. Yeah. So James was the grandfather of Soul, correct? Is that what he called himself, the granddaddy of Soul? He's the grandfather of funk or soul?
Funk.
You've been the grandfather of funk.
Yeah. He's the hardest working man in showbiz, is the other thing. But they had a bit of a rivalry, James and Solomon.
Wow. Music business is such a cool industry. The jazz industry is a cool industry, from the old speakeasies, eh? And of course, the marijuana came from the jazz community. Reefer Madness came along and then it was criminalized and then became decriminalized. Wow, things do change. And I still have a great record collection. It's amazing how vinyl has survived, eh, Steve? And a bit of an uptick in vinyl to boot in terms of sales. Again, within the last 10 years, it went completely dead. It was amazing. I'm not sure what happened to the industry. You once pressed great vinyl, and then all of a sudden the vinyl became so bad it used to warp, and you'd return it to A&A,
that was Sam's.
And you'd have to hold it up and say, is it warped or not, and put it on the table and spell, okay, even the quarter won't make it go away. but it went cheap, and if you buy vinyl today, and Jack, you saw the vinyl in my office, the Freddie Mercury one in Barcelona, I think it was. How thick that piece of vinyl.
Yeah, much higher quality for sure.
Unbelievable. And yet the presses, the last vinyl press, I think, is in Montreal in Canada, the only one left.
Oh, no. There's at least three just in
this area. Are they new presses or old presses?
Brand new presses.
New presses.
So there's a
company. Because they ran out of presses. I think they're down to one press in the country.
People were scouring all through Eastern Europe looking for parts for all the old presses. And then a company out of Czechoslovakia came up with a new style of pressing.
My turntable, the same turntable that was in the miniseries Suits, if you recall that.
Yeah, okay.
I have that exact same turntable at home, made in Czechoslovakia, yeah. Of all places.
They made a lot of
Why Czechoslovakia?
They just seem to have had a history of making high-end audio products. But
well, they're close to Germany, and yeah. Of course the Duel was a German product.
Yep.
But Czechoslovakia. And then what is the big jukebox, the Wurlitzer?
There's Wurlitzer. Is
that German? It sounds German.
I think, it's a German name, but I think they were actually invented in the U.S. I have a 1956 Seberg.
Is that what your jukebox is? It's a 1956.
Looks like the back end of a Caddy.
It is a really cool, but it actually plays records.
Yes.
45s or LPs?
45s.
45s.
So. Yeah, but
it's a beautiful looking machine.
Oh, they're gorgeous. They're absolutely gorgeous.
Has that machine appreciated in value?
Yeah, I got it for my 50th birthday and probably paid like $3,000 for it. And the last time I saw it, a similar one listed, it was like, $7,500.
So pacing inflation.
Yeah.
I had a few pinball machines and I moved. I had to trade them. They held their value. Yeah. I didn't make any money, but I was in a quick move to get rid of them.
Ed Robertson from the Bare Naked Ladies is a big pinball machine collector, if you need to.
Is that right?
If you need to unload anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. To your point, please. About pressing plants. In Burlington, there's a company called Precision, and they do over 1 million units a month pressing.
Is that a lot?
That's a lot.
You know, when I got in this business, Jack, one of our clients, and you'll laugh if I told you the name I'm not going to on air, he was holding Synram stock. This was 2001. And so I did a portfolio review and said, the first stock you're going to sell is Synram. Wait a minute, they make CDs. I said, yes, and it's on the decline, says Wolfgang Klein, and we bumped it out. I think it went to zero, obviously. Do they still make CDs?
Yep. There's still lots of smaller pressing plants that are making CDs. And again, if some of the press is to be believed, we are actually seeing an increase in CD sales as well.
So let's go to artists. Taylor Swift is Taylor Swift. And I don't know who a good artist to talk about is right here, right now, but how does an artist make money today in comparison to the way a traditional artist would make money, like a, Rolling Stones or Queen or even Pearl Jam?
Yeah, it's an incredibly challenging time for new artists because, again, you have to just give you an example. So Tidal, to make $1, you have to have 78 streams. Apple Music, to make $1, 125 streams. Amazon, to make $1, 249 streams. And it just, as you go
gross
down the list.
Gross or net?
Gross.
Then you got to pay your expenses off that.
Yeah. So you've got your publishing piece, you've got your master use piece, but that's how difficult it is.
So that's a penny, 1.2 pennies?
No, that's less than a
penny. No, 78 streams entitled to make $1.
Correct.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
78 to make, it's 1 penny per, just over 1 penny per
so
stream.
So you can begin
Spotify
to imagine.
Will pay you 0.00, they'll pay you 3 pennies per, they'll
no,
pay you,
point
they'll zero. Pay you less. So a third of a penny on Spotify. Mm. Oh my God. That's all Spotify paid to spin that song?
That's correct.
A third
Sorry,
of a
is
penny.
That the same for every single song? Because you referenced correct. Stairway to Heaven versus other
that,
new
that
artists.
Was under variable pricing in the download era. This is straight streaming. So every song gets that
So, but this is quite the divergence. So, Tidal Music is paying a penny a spend. A penny a spend. But Spotify is paying a third of a cent a spend. Amazon is paying 0.004 of a penny.
And then look at YouTube.
And then YouTube is paying 0.002. Is that good or bad? That's actually worse. That's even
so I say the strength of the company, wow. Wolf. The strength of the company determines, obviously, how much they have to pay.
Right. Obviously. That is correct. Yeah. Wow.
But it's also their network that they're dealing with, right? But you've got a much broader network when you have that distribution.
So if you download the song, they pay. So the more download, the more
they
pay.
The consumer never owns this.
Yep.
They license it from the service. So if your subscription run, if you let your subscription run out, you lose all that music. Where at least in the download days, you had a permanent...
So this is streaming, but people still do download because they want to be able to play offline as well.
Less and less so, but both Spotify and a couple of the others have offline functionality.
But so now, Steve, let's go back to the good news. The good news is because of digitization and because of streaming, a new life has been given, apparently, to the music industry, whereby gross revenue of music, gross sales of music, I don't care what form, now it's in zeros and ones as opposed to pieces of plastic, gross sales have never been higher. So that's good.
That's good. And
so who's getting the incremental? The artist or the label or the publisher? Or combination?
A combination.
Yeah.
Again, it depends on, if an artist is still unrecouped, if they still haven't paid back that label, they're not receiving any royalties until they do that.
Take Dark Side of the Moon. That record has sold, I think, Steve, 250 million copies. And I bought the vinyl, and I also bought a CD. Last thing I want to do is pay for a digital download. But if I listen to that song, if I listen to Money on, and we play it often on this show, and I try to give them 30 seconds so the artist actually gets something through the royalty stream in traditional radio. What is it? Sinram?
Simra.
Who's it?
Simra.
Simra. That's what they're called now. Anyways, but they continue to make money off that record without even selling the record.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they paid off that loan years and years ago.
Years ago.
That cash register, when it rings for people.
But it's amazing the power of those brands. Elton John, Freddie Mercury, Queen, of course. And you just go down, the Beatles, obviously. Those are powerful brands. And to see them to continue to reinvent themselves, repackage, create video, create a history of the artist, it's good stuff.
Well, and you've also hit on a very important point when you talked about the growth and just the money being made off of music these days. Is think about Warner Music, Universal Music, Sony Music, the depth of their catalog. So the last figure I read is for most of the majors, catalog accounts for a good 70% of their sales.
So I want to get to that, and we're running out of time, but see, I do want to ask that, because when I used to do business with Universal Music, that's actually where I first met you, was at PolyGram, which got gobbled up by Universal. But catalog was not the thing. It was about new music, and that's why you like dealing with The Edge, because they played your new rock music for you, whereas at Wolf, there's no money in catalog. And boy, have times changed. So I go back to the repackaging of catalog, and I want to speak about it. That must be a huge component of the business. You're just confirming with me what I thought. Yeah. 75%.
I'm speaking digitally, in streaming, 75% of that is generally, again, that's a general number. That's what's generated by catalog, about 75%.
So catalog is 75% of streaming.
But I'll throw one caveat in there. Record companies consider catalog 18 months and beyond. So in that catalog, say the last Ed Sheeran record, that's considered so you have shallow
months,
and deep catalog, but still that's what's throwing off money. So smaller independent labels don't have that luxury.
You know, it's funny, the name record company became the product, which became obsolete. But the truth is the name record company is from recording, and that remains. We're going to talk about that in January when we get Steve Kane back, the former president of Universal Music. The man's retired, but boy, he's going to more shows and hanging out at the Horseshoe Tavern, I think, more than ever. It's remarkable. Merry Christmas to you, Steve. It's been an absolute treat having a little tease with you to discuss an industry very, very dear to my heart, that being the music industry. We are going to pivot. Well, stay within the consumer category. I'll speak to our analyst. Is it Boston, Jack, where Susan Anderson is? She covers Elf Beauty. My daughter loves the product. We just went long the stock, making near all-time highs. Stay tuned.
Want to make more money? Stay tuned for more Hi-Fi Radio on 640 Toronto.
show's Hi-Fi Radio, show about money. We spent some time talking about the consumer. Steve King just spent a good chat with us talking about the music industry and consumer taste and artists' power and challenges, shall I say. We're cruising over to New York. Lovely time of the year to go to New York. Christmas time, of course. Susan Anderson, one of our analysts. Did you dig that little tune I gave you, Susan, as an intro?
Loved it.
But that was not in a New York minute, Susan. Big delay. Hello. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. How's the vibe this Christmas season in New York?
It's good. Consumers are out shopping. The crowds are out. I think, you know, inflation coming down, particularly at the pump, is really helping. And I think also we're seeing some higher promotions, I guess more normalization of promotions, which is, you know, giving them a little incentive to spend. So it seems like the consumer's been pretty resilient.
We're seeing pretty much the same thing up here. So I did a little stocking stuffer purchasing today. I can't believe Christmas is just a few days away. Truly, it got away from me. But I'm taking a bit of a different approach to Christmas these days. I sort of back off a little bit, just, you know, accept it for what it is. But I had to buy some stocking stuffers. You know, when your spouse says, "Don't buy anything for me, buy something for them." Anyways, so I bought a little Chanel. I can't believe how expensive Chanel is for a half bottle, like a small bottle, $140. But then they give you some promo and you get knocked down to $110. But $110, that must be a high margin business. But my daughter is all over e.l.f. products. She's 16. And so I just did a little bit of anecdotal market research when I went to Shoppers Drug Mart and I said, "How's the e.l.f. selling?" And the cosmetician looked at me. Why is he asking me that question? I said, "Well, my daughter buys the stuff." And she said, "Ah." And we're not talking Elf on the Shelf, friends. No, Elf Beauty. And she said, "Oh, no, it's really, really good selling product. It sells a lot, And I said, "Well, who's buying it?" She said, "Well, basically 16 to 24-year-olds. And I said, I said, "Why do they like it so much?" She said, "Well, because it's very affordable. If you're under 10 bucks, you can actually get yourself some product." Well, so I like that business plan. You know, compared to the Chanel at one, right? So talk to us a little bit about e.l.f. The stock's hitting all-time highs.
Yeah.
Is it going higher or is it ahead of itself? Because the stock also came from, about $20, which scares me. It came from about $20 or $25 2 years ago. It's now trading $150. That's about a seven-bagger in short order.
Yeah.
So, Wolfie come lately just buying the stock. Could have put the stench on it to knock it down. So any legs left in e.l.f. or would you be chipping it out and taking profit?
No, we think so. I mean, they still have a lot of market share to gain. You talk about in Canada, if your daughter buys it, that's great to hear because that's one of their international markets that they're growing rapidly in, but still underpenetrated versus the U.S. So, you know, we see a lot of shelf space gains left for them. Also in skincare, they have very little market share and they just bought Naturium, which is a massive skincare brand, which is going to, I think, be another growth vehicle for them. So this is one of our top picks in beauty for 2024.
You know, it's funny because they create these categories within beauty. And I tease my daughter and she plays with me. But, you know, she said, "Look, Daddy, I just bought this new micro-enhancing elixifier." Huh? It's standard, Daddy. You put it on first before you put on the prime. It's just these chemical layers of things, but they buy into it. It's genius. It's genius. You know, it truly, truly is. But the L'Oreal family, boy, did you see that, Susan? The documentary, I think it's called "On the Richest Woman on the Planet," and the heiress to the L'Oreal family.
I didn't see it.
Oh, it's good. It's a mini series on Netflix. She was basically bamboozled.
I'm gonna have to check it out.
Oh yeah, no, you got to watch it. It's really, really good. You'd enjoy it too, Steve. You're retired. You got time on your hands. It's a good thing, buddy. But let's talk about Estee Lauder. That stock was a darling. It was a play on China. It was about a play on travel, because when you travel and you arrive at the airport 3 hours in advance so you can get your overhead compartment, you spend time shopping, apparently. And, apparently people are buying cosmetics. You do that, Jack, when you travel?
No cosmetics, Wolf.
No cosmetics. But your daughter's getting into it, right?
She will be, and she'll be on that e.l.f. Bandwagon for sure.
Yeah. And Susan, before you answer that, Steve, I'd ask you, I'm a big Cure fan. Who's the lead singer of The Cure?
Robert Smith.
What's with the makeup?
It's always been there, hasn't it?
It's bad, but it's bad. I saw an early video of him doing, I think, not Boys Don't Cry. It was another huge, huge hit. And it was a great video. And he had makeup back then, but that was 35, 40 years ago. He's, older guy, just doesn't work. But it's him, his brand.
Right? I wonder if he's using Estee Lauder. And that stock's been knocked on the mat, so let's back to you, Susan. Estee Lauder. Signs of hope or mismanaged company? Because I spoke to a fellow from TD who thinks mismanaged, stay away.
Yeah, well, so, you know, it's sold off quite a bit and it's recovered from the bottom. You know, we're still on the sidelines because China is still seeing some troubles, especially the cosmetics area. Just the growth has not been good. Travel still is not great. They're very penetrated in travel, maybe too saturated. So, you know, I think there is going to have to be some changes there before we can get excited about the name. And then in North America, even though, you know, last quarter department stores seem fine with beauty, but it's still a channel that's, you know, in a secular decline. So, you know, we still remain on the sidelines there, but watching that one because it is Estee Lauder. And I do think that, you know, one day they'll probably get back on track, but, you know, still a ways off.
It's an incredible business. It's a fascinating business. Again, Steve Kane sitting here in the studio. I used to do business with Steve back in my radio days, and he knows the music industry inside and out. I love the industry, but I also love the fashion industry. I think it's just a really, really cool industry. You know, it's got its nuances and its quirks. And I remember when the radio station I worked for actually put on a fashion show. It was called Close to the Edge. And it was that over at Roy Thompson Hall. And we brought in a fellow named Kelly Clipperton. He did all the choreographing of it. He ended up singing a big song. We tied all this into the CASBY Music Awards. Full circle, fashion, music, entertainment. It's lovely stuff. But beauty does, well, apparently matter. My daughter has no trouble being late for school as she's finishing up that mascara, Susan. It's a powerful force. Indeed it is.
Sounds like my daughter.
Yeah, but I think social media has so much to do with that. And even these phones. I think my daughter's actually reading. She's not. She's looking at herself with her camera on her phone. Jack's looking at me. You wait, sure. You watch. Your daughter's 12. Mine's 16. Oh, Shivani Vani. I love my daughter. What a great show. I want to appreciate Susan for your time. All the best to you in that fabulous city in New York. Have a great Christmas and keep the world beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Steve Kane. Thank you for dropping. We're going to bring you back in January. I want to dig deeper into the music industry. Friends at home, any questions for Jack or I? Please, just look us up, wolfgangklein.com, thewolfonbaystreet.com. No question too big, no question too small. We answer them all. And again, this year we've been trying to give you ideas to build wealth. Clients of ours are compounding their money. Just look at the website. It's slow, steady, you know, high single digits, low double digits. Growth portfolio up about 10% on the year. And if you're one of those, please, we helped you make some money. Give back. It is better to give than receive. Lots of great causes out there. It's cold out there. Homelessness is on the rise. Affordability is beyond reach for many. Please help your neighbor. It'll make a better city and it'll make you feel real good. And guess what? Do it in size and get a good tax deduction. Donate stock that's appreciated. Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, all near 52-week highs. Give a little away to a great charity. You won't pay the capital gains tax, and the charity will receive the full value, and so will you when you deduct it from your tax return. Save about 40% in taxes. That's a good idea. Have a great weekend. Love you.
You've been listening to Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Harthill, portfolio managers at Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. For questions about today's show or any questions about money, email wolfandjack@wolfgangklein.com. Hi-Fi Radio. For the love of money. Join us again next week.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.